thank you very much for that very lengthy introduction. And you will admit that Professor Bahaduri is always so profound and lucid that it's a hard act to follow. So I'm not going to try and follow it, but I am grateful that he's actually raised some of the issues that I'm going to be looking at in the specific case of the global food crisis and the relationship with finance. So I'm looking at really one particular transmission channel of finance and the real economy. And in this, as Professor Bahaduri mentioned, regulation is, of course, just one of the different elements that creates a certain process, a volatile process. But in the case of food, I would like to emphasize it because I think it is something that has been relatively underreported in terms of the specific relationship between finance and food. Okay, now first point we'll have to make, I think Jomo made it already in the morning, but let's just remind ourselves that actually the global food crisis continues. It hit the headlines a year ago and everyone was suddenly talking about it, but then after Lehman Brothers collapsed, it disappeared from the international public radar and nobody really talked about it anymore, even though it actually continues. And, of course, we all know, I don't have to tell this audience, that it has a disproportionate impact on women and girls, so I'm not going to belabor that point. But the point I'd like to make is that the dramatic increase and then decrease of the global food prices that we have seen in the period since January 2007 is really very closely connected with financial speculation. We've had massive and historically unprecedented changes. I actually looked at the World Bank data for a century. I mean, they have data going back to 1911, so close to a century on major commodity prices. And we have not seen this degree of swing within the space of 18 months ever before. Somehow, the attitude towards the global food crisis seems to be that, oh, well, you know, prices have fallen now, and so it's all right. There's no crisis anymore. It's over. But that's unwarranted, and I'm going to talk about why. And I'd also just like to mention that actually food insecurity in developing countries is now much greater than ever before, and certainly greater than it was during what was seen as the peak of the food crisis about a year ago. Just to give you some idea of the volatility, these are three major food commodities, rice, wheat, and maize. The blue line is rice, the maroon line is wheat, and green is maize. And you can see that in particular wheat and rice have had very, very dramatic. I mean, they increased by a factor of 3 times. Maize slightly less, 2.5 times, but rice and wheat about 3 times. And then fell equally sharply, so that you actually have, by April, you have prices lower than they were a year ago, sometimes as much as 30% lower. In the case of some of the commodities, rice the only exception, but rice also back to where it was about a year ago. This is just to give you that similar things were happening, but to a lesser extent in the cash crops, in cotton, soybean, and groundnut. Cotton, you will notice the blue line below, didn't change much, and that's because, of course, continuing U.S. subsidies on cotton allowed the global prices to be very, very stable relative to all the others. Groundnut and soybean also increased by more than 2 times, but not as much as the food prices. But the critical point is that these do not reflect real demand and supply. In a sense, that should be obvious. If they go up and come down within the space of 18 months, it can't really be that that reflects real tendencies. But it's worth noting that actually production in this very period, even in the period of the rising prices, production increased faster than utilization. So there was an increase in stock holding in this period from admittedly low levels. The amount that was actually traded fell. And there was, at the peak of the crisis, there was a very common argument made, particularly in this country. Both President Bush and Condoleezza Rice made it, for example, that China and India were eating too much. That, you know, there was this increase in incomes in these very large populous countries, and that naturally meant more food consumption, and that therefore led to this increase in global demand. Now, that's completely false, because both the aggregate and per capita consumption in these countries was falling in this period because of global income distribution, internal income distribution reasons and so on, but it's a completely wrong argument. Well, there are details about this which I will not go into. It's basically showing that production increased by 5.4%, utilization increases by only 3.4% in the period of the rising food prices. And whether you include China and India or exclude them, you get the same result. Now, it's not the case that there are no supply factors that are important in the food issue, shall I say, the global food issue. It certainly there are. There's the very important short-run factor, which was mentioned by Jomo in the morning, the diversion of both acreage and output for biofuel production, particularly maize production. About one-third of the EU's production and imports, and slightly more than one-third of the U.S. production of maize is now diverted to ethanol production, and certainly that has had an impact. And there are medium-term factors. There's the whole issue of the rising cost of inputs. There's inadequate credit to cultivators. There's a very important issue, again, inadequately addressed, of falling soil productivity. And this is very sharp in some regions of India. It's as much as 30% in a decade. There's inadequate public investment in agricultural research and extension, which has contributed to this. And, of course, there has been an impact of climate change on harvests. We do know that there's a clear pattern now in terms of adverse impact on harvests. But I will argue that the critical role has been played by speculation. Now, once again, Professor Bhaduri has already told you about this, so I have less work to do here. But, you know, the general, shall we say, the mainstream approach has been that speculators play a positive role. They predict future market patterns, and by doing so, they reduce the intensity of change. So they reduce the volatility, they stabilize the price, in a sense. Because when it's going to fall, they predict the fall if it is profitable. The idea was that for speculation to be profitable, it should anticipate the future change and therefore bring it forward, in a sense. And similarly, there was an argument in favor of commodity futures markets, that they're supposed to reduce risk for cultivators and for purchasers. How? Well, because they allow for better risk management. They allow producers and consumers and others to hedge against future changes. They enable what's called the open market price discovery of commodities by buying and selling on the exchanges, and all of that gives you lower transaction costs. This was the argument that drove a very fundamental deregulation which occurred in the United States, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. Just in passing, I'd like to note that this was something that was earlier championed a great deal by Larry Summers, currently advising President Obama. What it does do is it exempts the over-the-counter commodity trades. So from the oversight by the regulator, by the Commodity Futures Transaction Commission, Trading Commission. And unregulated commodity exchanges and transactions, they allow all investors, including hedge funds, pension funds, investment banks, to trade in commodity futures contracts without any position limits, without any disclosure requirements, or any regulatory oversight at all. It was estimated that at the end of 2007, really, you know, kind of when the prices were heading to their peak, such unregulated trading was around $9 trillion, which is more than twice the value of the commodity contracts on the regulated exchanges. There was a particular loophole in the 2000 legislation. It's called the swap dealer loophole, which allows, you see, the idea was that commodity futures should be engaged in by those who are going to deal in the commodities, who are interested in holding these commodities, if not now, but in the future. But this particular loophole allowed anybody, these other financial agents, to enter the market, essentially through something that is now known as index trading. That is, you profit from changes in the price by taking on futures contracts, which you do not hold. You sell them before their time is up. You're periodically rolling over commodity futures contracts prior to your maturity and reinvesting in new contracts. So you're really only dealing in forward positions. There's no physical ownership of the commodities. So what happened? As the U.S. housing market imploded, finance is searching for new avenues of speculation. And they all enter, I think Jomo mentioned in the morning, they move from New York to Chicago. And so they actually drive up the prices through this process of engaging in this rollover of the futures contracts. But this process, of course, inevitably has to come to a limit. But the particular thing that drives the limit is that when the losses in the U.S. housing and other markets become too intense, many of these financial agents have to come back and book their losses, essentially, and have to cover their losses, provide liquidity for other. Already the credit crunch is beginning to emerge. So essentially what happens, commodity markets became like other financial markets, prone to information asymmetries and on all of this. And this is proved by the fact that if you look in the period between January 2007 and June 2008, the markets are in what is called contango. That is, the futures prices were higher than the spot prices. Whereas if they were only used for hedging, then they should actually have shown backwardation. That is, the futures prices should be lower than the spot prices. This is just to give you an idea of the kind of, you can see the black line is the total, the movement of the price. And the bars give you the extent of the investment by the different categories of traders. And here is the OTC, the over-the-counter trading, which 92% of which was in all these other commodities. Very little of it was in gold and precious metals, most of it. And you can see the spike that comes up by the end of 2007. Now, what matters is that, therefore, you have food markets that become like financial markets. And that's bad news because, you know, these are inherently kind of wrong signaling devices, if you like. So and these end up manipulating market behavior. So you have this extraordinary volatility. It was also true, by the way, in oil and minerals and so on. But in for food in particular, you get these very confusing and misleading market price signals for farmers. So you have oversowing in some phases, undercultivation in other phases. The point that's relevant here is that there was a very high pass-through of global prices on consumer prices in the developing countries, but the subsequent fall in prices had very low pass-through. So what has happened is that both the cultivators and the food consumers lost out, and the only gainers were the financial intermediaries who were profiting from the changing prices. So we still have a continuing food crisis. In April, FAO estimates that 33 countries have severe or moderate food crisis, and conditions in at least 17 were worse compared to October last year. And many countries where there was already widespread hunger have experienced a greater increase in the food price, and therefore a greater evidence of this the food crisis. Already, you know, spot surveys have found declining nutrition indicators, lower BMI in some African countries, Indonesia, and so on. Just to give you an idea of the pass-through, if you look at the left-hand side, gives you the number of countries, the percentage of developing countries in which the latest price is greater than a year earlier or the maximum on record, and that is on average above 80% of developing countries, and in the case of rice, all sub-Saharan African countries, okay, but generally 80%. However, if you look at the global food price, for rice, it's down 30% compared to a year earlier. For wheat, it's down nearly 40%. For maize, it's down 31%. For sorghum, it's down 38%. So clearly, the pass-through has not actually affected in terms of declines. This is further proof of that. This is specifically some particular countries, the global price of rice. You will find that some countries have managed better than others. China, the orange line at the bottom, very little increase in price. However, India, Bangladesh, Philippines, rise in price followed by stability at the higher level rather than a decline. And similarly, you find with Ghana, which dominantly imported rice, Sri Lanka, spiky but nonetheless very sharp, and Colombia as well, rice prices have continued to increase. So there's a differential performance. Domestic food production is critical. Domestic ability to distribute is critical. And countries with a high import propensity have been very badly affected, especially the cash crop exporters, okay? Because they then are facing the price decline for exports. So what's the lesson? That no country, however small or open, can afford to neglect domestic food production and must ensure at least some domestic supplies or regional arrangements to ensure food. Otherwise, it will be caught in this vortex, which is not of its own making and which is determined by these global financial movements. So there are roles for national policy. You have to have state intervention, obviously, for food price stability and food security. But I'm going to take minus one if that's all right with everyone. But developing countries actually don't often have the fiscal resources to do this. Many of them already have large fiscal deficits, often as an outcome of the financial crisis itself because of declining tax revenues. They are increasingly crowded out of international capital markets. There has been a movement of capital back to the US and to Europe. And private capital moving out also causes currency devaluation. That makes food imports more expensive. So developing countries are really caught in a pincer movement between volatile global prices and falling exports on the one hand, and reduced fiscal space and depreciating currencies, on the other hand. So we need many real economy measures. We need national government intervention to protect agriculture, to provide more public support, to create and administer better domestic food distribution systems. But we also need international arrangements. We need things like strategic grain reserves, commodity boards, and other measures. Especially the measures we need in finance are specific regulation of commodity futures markets. We need very strict limits, even bans on the entry of financial players into commodity futures, elimination of the swap dealer loophole, banning of futures markets for grain trade in countries where public institutions do play an important role, and also capital account management techniques. This is a euphemism for capital controls, to prevent the destabilizing impact of capital flows that cause the currency devaluation and then affect domestic food prices. I think in relation to what was discussed this morning, the prognosis is that we will, in the short to medium term, get once more an increase in global food prices for a variety of reasons, some of which were discussed in the morning. There is a real concern that this may once again lead to speculative capital movements because the financial regulation that could control it is still not in place. The Obama administration has recently decided that it will ban OTC dealing in commodity trade, but that's still far from adequate, and it's not going to work if it just causes it to move to European exchanges where there's much greater deregulation. And so this is an urgent demand to be made also in terms of financial regulation by women and other progressive groups. Okay, thank you.